Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry tells Beaches residents we're all in this together when it comes to paying off the city's pension obligations. But some are skeptical. We'll take a closer look coming up right here. And good morning live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the NPR One app and watch the show video on demand with our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, how Beaches residents are reacting to the mayor's proposed pension solution. You can get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, are school dress codes body shaming your daughter? That's the allegation some are making. We'll take a closer look as kids head back to class this week and next week around the area. And later, a new era for the Women's Center of Jacksonville. All of that ahead. But first this hour, Mayor Lenny Curry has been traveling around the area, drumming up support for his proposed solution to Jacksonville's massive unfunded pension liability. He's facing a tough sell in some quarters, though. For example, some in the Beaches communities have pushed back against the idea of extending a half-cent sales tax to pay down pension debt, although many others are supportive, where the mayor received more than 60% of the vote in his election. But here's the question that was posed at a recent town hall out in Neptune Beach. Why should Beaches residents vote for a half-cent sales tax that they seemingly would receive nothing from to pay for a problem they didn't contribute to? We're going to look at this right now as we welcome Rory Diamond, Vice President of Beaches Watch. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And Beaches businessman John McGowan. Good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Where do you stand on Mayor Curry's proposed pension solution? And especially we want to hear from folks out at the Beaches. Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. And email and tweet us or weigh in on our Facebook page. Rory, let's begin with you. You're the vice president of Beaches Watch. The other day, Mayor Curry and City Councilman Bill Gulliford appeared at a town hall, reminding everyone at the Beaches that the entire community is in this together in solving this crippling budget issue. They urged a yes vote on the proposed half-cent sales tax on August 30th. As you look at the feedback you're getting in your capacity as Vice President of Beaches Watch, where is the Beaches community on this issue, would you say?
Sure. So first, you know, Beaches Watch is a nonpartisan organization. Our purpose is just to educate voters, and that's why we had a forum with the mayor and Councilman Gulliford where people could ask questions about it. And I think generally speaking, as you noted, people are supportive of the mayor out at the Beaches. He had a huge majority of the votes out there in his election a year ago. So I think they're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. But we have heard some naysayers talk about this particular referendum, and the questions are fair. Some of them are about this is a new tax, some are what's in it for the Beaches, or the questions we're getting.
Right. And John McGowan, as you're listening to feedback out in the Beaches, you've heard, it sounds like a mix of pro and con.
Yeah, and we do hear a lot of the con. The local paper, the Beaches Leader, has actually come out against this. A lot of the editorials in that have been against it. Former Mayor Jacksonville Beach has come out against it. And they do have legitimate concerns. I mean, we got to remember that the dynamic between the Beaches and the city of Jacksonville is different. If you live in Arlington, it's just your city. And you may want to look out for your part of town, but it's still just your city. At the Beaches, we have a city-county relationship. So there is a city of Jacksonville Beach. We have our own government. We have our own police department. We have our own fire department. And we funded those. And we don't have the pension debt that the city of Jacksonville does. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't receive benefit from the city of Jacksonville. But we've done very well, cut what needed to be cut to make sure that we weren't running up the pension debt like the city of Jacksonville did.
Rory Diamond, is that's what's driving the pushback, this sense at the Beaches that people there have kept their fiscal house in order and they don't want to be part of bailing out the rest of the county for dealing with its issues?
Yeah, I think that's the fair way to look at this. People say, okay, for example, in Neptune Beach, we have our own police department, we have our own police pension fund, and it's 84% funded. And it's that well funded because we made tough choices over several decades. For example, our police officers haven't had a cost of living adjustment since 1995. So those are tough choices that we made in Neptune Beach that haven't been made by the city of Jacksonville. I think there's just a generalized anger that we're in this situation at all. In Neptune Beach, we made good choices, but Jacksonville didn't. Why should Neptune Beach residents have to bail out the city? That said, I think most of those people realize that we have a relationship with Jacksonville that's important. and that we don't really have a better option out there right now. And so I think most of them will vote yes in the end.
You do. And we want your calls on Mayor Curry's proposed pension solution, especially if you're out at the beaches as we talk about that part of town today. Give us a call at 549-2937. John McGowan, as the Florida Times Union reported, under the current Better Jacksonville plan, the beaches communities and Baldwin receive a percentage of revenue each year based on population. Jacks Beach gets the most. Atlantic Beach and Neptune Beach get under $1 million. Baldwin gets less than $100,000. If this proposed half-cent sales tax is approved, it would kick in after the Better Jacksonville plan expires. That's quite a few years out. However, as the TU reports, the flow of money to the beaches would stop if the voters give this a thumbs up at the beaches. Accurate? And is that part of the pushback here?
Well, I think what people don't understand is that money's going to stop no matter what. The Better Jacksonville plan ends in 2030. That's when it's done. And that money going to the beaches is going to stop whether we approve this plan or not. It's two different.
It would have happened anyway.
It would have happened anyway. It's not like if you vote for the Yes on One program that Mayor Curry's proposed that suddenly we're going to lose money. This money was going to end no matter what. It was designed to help bring Jacksonville to the next level. That was the entire program behind Better Jacksonville, building all these great infrastructure, and it has served its purpose, and it's time for that to expire. So we're not losing something by doing this. What we're gaining by voting on it is maintaining those services. And I think that's the biggest thing is the beaches, sometimes we forget that we are an island.
Yeah, literally and figuratively. Yeah.
And we believe that we operate as an island, but the truth is we do gain benefit when Jacksonville succeeds.
Yeah.
And we receive law enforcement. You know, 4th of July, Jacksonville Sheriff's Office comes out every year to help out. That's not required in the interlocal agreement. That is something that either Rutherford or when Rutherford was sheriff, he did, and Mike Williams continues to do. They do that because they know we work together and we're one community. And I think that's the one thing that we continue to forget at the beach, that we do gain benefit from this.
That's the challenge for the mayor in making this case, isn't it, Rory? Especially when you consider that culturally, every once in a while I'll still see a bumper sticker on someone's car that says, "I do not cross the ditch." Although I don't think that's as popular now as it used to be.
Oh, no, I think it's still a thriving culture out at the beach. Absolutely.
Okay.
We're our own island paradise. And you know, personally, I'd rather not cross the ditch if I don't have to. I don't like to let my bike go.
I'm so glad you both sacrificed and came downtown today.
But no, I think the mayor's pitch that he made at our forum, and I think his job to sell his referendum, is to explain that this is a problem that needs a solution. There's no way to just sleep on this one. You can't kick the can any further down the field than it already has been. So do we take this poison pill or a different poison pill? Either way, we're taking a poison pill.
All right, let's go to your calls, especially if you're out at the beaches. Where do you stand on the mayor's proposed pension solution? How will you vote? 549-2937. No calls from the beaches yet, but calls from all over town. We'll start with Rick in Arlington. Hi, Rick. Good morning. Rick, give us a call back. It's 549-2937. Aaron is in Mandarin. Hey, Aaron, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How about you, Melissa?
Doing great.
All right. Well, I think this whole sales tax thing is being looked at in the total wrong way. We're asking people for Jacksonville to pay for Jacksonville's problem, and yes, that does sound right, but we're actually recruiting jobs into Jacksonville with city money, and we're letting them go to outside city people. You know, I live in South Mandarin, so that means Julington Creek Plantation. You go up the north side, they're talking Yulee, all those subdivisions that are being built up there. Every big city that I've been to, Philadelphia, Denver, has a tax that you have to pay if you work inside the city, if you live outside the city. I don't see why we don't try to do something like that rather than just saying, hey, all the people inside the city are going to pay for it. They'd never want to pay for it. Nobody ever wants to get off anything, unfortunately. So let's try a different route, and let's make the people that use our roads, that take our jobs, and everything else. St. John's County doesn't have anything on Jacksonville, and neither do our peripheral counties. If they want to bone up and make their own city, great for them. If not, they're weaving off our juice. That's how I feel it. So I think we're going about this the wrong way. Let's figure out what money we can scrape together besides before we dig into our pockets. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. John.
Yeah, I have an answer to that. I think what he's missing is this actually kind of does what he's talking about. I don't agree with his assessment of our relationship with the surrounding counties, but what a sales tax does versus a property tax, a sales tax means everybody that comes in the county, even tourists that use the services like law enforcement and fire, you know, they're going to be contributing to this when they make a purchase. And if the alternative that we're looking at on this is either going to a property tax, well, a property tax actually is just paid by the residents here. And what's interesting is that's the alternative. And for the specifically back to the beaches, that would be the worst answer for the beaches, because then we're definitely going to be, you know, contributing more than our fair share. Then it's going to be a whole nother conversation.
Because property at the beaches is valued at a higher
rate, and then you get
that's your position on that.
Well, correct. Plus, then we got the interlocal agreement, and that's a whole can of worms. We could spend the whole show talking about the interlocal agreement, but
I still it's deceptively simple, but very complex all at the same time. It seems like
and. Basically, for those of y'all that don't live at the beach and don't hear this term all the time, it's like common vernacular for us at the beach, but it's our contract between the cities and the county. And it just defines what services the county has to provide the cities. And there are some things that you know, I said, we have our own police department, so the county doesn't have to provide a police department, but they do have to provide a library. They come out and they clean the beach. There are just a number of standard things that the county provides that any typical city-county relationship would have. It's just more difficult in Jacksonville because Jacksonville is a city and a county at the same time.
Let me ask you, Rory, and by the way, both you and John are in support of this plan. You're both going to vote yes. Here is a column that appeared in today's Florida Times-Union from Tom Majonix. He's the executive director of 3 KIPP schools in the city, and he writes, I voted for Mayor Curry. I supported his campaign financially, and I respect his efforts to find a solution to this problem. But the mayor has proposed a plan whose cornerstone is a new $4 billion pension bailout tax, the largest in city history. It protects the status quo of unsustainable pension benefits, refinances pension debt against the advice of his own financial advisors at a cost of $1.5 billion to taxpayers. It kicks the can to Jacksonville's children, and it's all tax, no reform. What are your thoughts about the opposition here?
Well, the opposition has fair arguments. There's no question that this will cost $1.5 billion more by extending out the time that this has to be paid back. It's also a tax on our kids and our grandkids. There's no question these are facts. But give us a better option. You know, throw out something else that makes more sense than this. If we raise the millage rates, that's just going to accelerate what the last caller was talking about, which is people moving to St. John's County and other places and taking advantage of Jacksonville. If we don't invest,
you think that even in $100 more a year in property tax for the average homeowner, you think that would cause a flow out of Duval?
I think generally increasing property taxes is going to accelerate the number of people who'd rather live in St. John's County and take advantage of all the benefits of that county and then working in Jacksonville, which is the problem. We have people using city services but not paying our city taxes. Mm-hmm. This would be paid by anybody who bought anything in Duval County.
Here's a tweet for you guys. This is another reason why the beaches should consider creating Ocean County. We should keep our money out here at the beach. That's from Amy.
This has come up a couple of times. We've actually voted on it twice. Two times, the beaches cities have tried to form their own county, Ocean County. Both times, it's Rory's city that's been the problem. Neptune Beach has voted against it twice.
They're the troublemakers.
We can blame Rory against it. It's come back up. It's a conversation that about 3 months ago, we really started to hear that a lot from the people that were, you know, the ingrained beach people, the people that have been in leadership out there for a long time. They started talking about it again. Honestly, there may be a point where it comes back on the ballot. I don't think this is going to drive it to it this year, but is the relationship between the city and the county and the cities deteriorates and has its issues, that does come up. Fortunately, Mayor Curry has actually done a lot to help repair
strengthen
damage.
The relationships, yeah.
Under the last mayor, there was not a very good relationship between the two. And the Neptune Beach threatened to sue a couple times. And I think they did actually sue.
No, we didn't actually sue, but it sure would have been fun if we had.
Yeah, they tried.
there certainly seems to be a Brexit-style contingent at the beaches. Whether it's the majority or not, I think, is up for discussion.
It has always been a very independent thing. And you just look at the fact that we're still independent cities as opposed to joining the county in consolidation when it originally went through.
Okay, let's go back now to Rick in Arlington. I hope we have him back. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. What we've been talking about is passing this on, cutting the pensions and stuff. I have yet to hear any word about the exempt people and the administration, including the mayor. What are we doing with their pensions? Are we modifying those so they don't have the big payout? It seems like when this whole thing started, it was the city who got involved in this mess. They're the ones who approved it. But now they want to back out all the promises and stuff and say, oh, we got this big problem. They never funded it. So I think we need to look at the mayor's pension and some of the exempt people in the administration's pension who have great benefits and roll out of here with a lot of money instead of just looking at, well, the three unfunded ones or underfunded ones. And make the difference on law enforcement and for the corrections and the fire. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Rory.
I mean, it's a fair question to say, hey, what's going on with other folks? But the big problem that we have are the police, fire, and the prison guards' pension. Those are the ones that are creating this huge unfunded liability of $2.85 billion. So that's the problem. That's what needs to be fixed one way or the other.
Elizabeth in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Elizabeth. Good morning.
Hi. So I'm a younger voter, so I don't really, and I live out at Jacks Beach. I actually own two properties out here. I'm 30. I'm definitely voting for this plan. I would not be able to own property out in Jacks Beach if I did not work in the city. So, I mean, when I'm in the city most of the day, when you think about it, you're using all those services. So I don't really even necessarily look at it as a bailout. I'm utilizing those services, and I wouldn't have my life out at the beach without that. I would be interested in learning more about, I mean, why Jacks Beach, Neptune Beach, and Atlantic Beach, the need for three different why we couldn't just merge forces. Like, you know, when you're going through Neptune and you see those cop cars that are so nice and fancy, it just seems like, are we spending our money? I mean, could we combine forces and utilize taxpayer dollars in a better way?
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth. She's calling from Jacks Beach. A yes vote.
Well, and she, her concerns... I think it may be she's actually highlights some of the different dynamic of the people that have recently moved to the beach and the people that have lived there forever. And, I still get – they still throw rocks at me because I went to Terry Parker High School instead of going to Fletcher. I'm this evil person that grew up 5 minutes away. But, you know, the beach – the reason there's a huge benefit to us having our own cities. And I believe that if you look at the crime rates and what's going on around the city, having a dedicated police department dedicated to a certain area that we fund, as the crime rates around the city have grown and gone down and everything, Jacksonville Beach can control and Neptune Beach can control what's going on within their own cities, and you get better response time. The response time at the beach is about a third of what it is in Jacksonville because they're closer by, they're more dedicated.
You think it's worth the extra layers of bureaucracy
different
departments?
It really is. It costs a little bit more, but it really, our taxes aren't that much more. They're a little bit more, but we don't pay that much more in taxes. The benefit is far more.
And here's a tweet for you from Rob. What are the benefits Jacks Beach is receiving from Jacksonville that would justify this tax contribution? I mean, that's the basic question here.
Right,
Rory,
if you look at the interlocal agreement, it lists all the things that the county has to do for us, right? You know, it has to do certain things as far as, you know, fire and as far as the police, so on and so forth. But you know, just like any relationship you have with a county government, if you're a city, the better off that county government is, the more services going to be able to provide you. So, for example, in Neptune Beach, we can have county-owned roads repaved more often. We can have the sides of the street mowed more often. We can have more JSO participation in Neptune Beach to help us when there's big problems, like on the 4th of July. It's a good government question. The better off Jacksonville is, the more they can offer the beach cities.
Mark is on the west side. Hey, Mark, how are you today?
Hey, Melissa, great. While I've been waiting to get on, I've been on the Skyway Express for about the last 15 minutes, totally alone. Anyway, my comment on this is, you know, not the relative merits of the plan, which I don't think there are any, but I'm concerned, where is Mayor Curry getting all this money, about $2.5 million, I understand now, to advertise on TV and to do these radio spots touting his version of the plan? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this money is coming from outside the city, outside the state. And to me, that's, first off, why he has to do that, I don't know. You know, let the plan stand on its own merits. But it's a smack of corruption. I mean, what's the quid pro quo here? Why are these people out of state donating to Mayor Curry? And, you know, It's just wrong, and that's the aspect I think we should be looking at.
Okay, and sorry you're all alone on the Skyway, Mark, but thanks for calling. And by the way, Mayor Curry appeared on this program a couple months ago. I forgot to play this portion of his comments about the solution earlier. Let's listen to the mayor very quickly talking about this Yes for Jacksonville plan.
Right now, we spend $260 million a year this year in pension costs. Next year, it'll be $280 million. The year after that, it'll be $300 million. So that's about 30% of a billion-dollar operating budget. What that means is whatever it is that taxpayers care about in this city, whatever their tax dollars are being paid in now to the city, 30% of that, almost $300 million, go to something that does absolutely nothing for them. We are on the brink of a financial crisis right now. What's happened over the years because of all this money going into pension is services have slowly deteriorated, city services. Mm-hmm. We are like the frog in the boiling water right now, and the day of reckoning has arrived.
Okay. John McGowan, that's Mayor Lenny Curry saying the city's like a frog in a pot of boiling water. What about that comment? And what about Mark's call that he doesn't like the fact that the Yes for Jacksonville campaign is getting a lot of PAC money to sell the plan?
Politics has a lot of money in it. And what we've actually seen a huge increase in donations in the local elections coming from outside areas, even in the beaches. We got an election going on in Jacksonville Beach that's coming up in November. I did a rundown on it, and only I think 20% of the money that had been donated to the Jacksonville Beach elections had actually come from people that live in Jacksonville Beach. It's not that uncommon anymore. And we can question the motives of why somebody would donate to somebody that's they don't have a direct vested interest in. But I believe we have to look at the person that's making that decision. And, you know, people say that sometimes, you know, their money's buying politicians. And I don't believe that, because when you get a lot of money coming in from a lot of different sources, they have conflicting interests, and you can't just serve everybody that's donated to you. Is somebody that's gotten a bunch of $25 donations somehow better than the person that's got the same amount of donations, but they're in larger dollar amounts? It just comes down to the person, that person's judgment, whether you believe that person has the ethics to not feel like they owe that person something.
Taylor in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Taylor. Hi, Taylor. Give us a call back. Taylor was waiting on hold a long time. But I'm sorry, finish your thought. I cut you off there by mistake.
Taylor lost interest in me is what happened. She just hung up. She's like, I don't want to hear John anymore.
And we're continuing our conversation about where Beach's residents are when it comes to voting yes or no on Mayor Curry's proposed pension reform solution, as we speak with Beach's Watch Vice President Rory Diamond and Beach's businessman John McGowan. Lots of calls continuing to come into the show. Let's go now to Haley in Intercoastal West. Hi, Haley. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, speaking of the money coming in from outside of Jacksonville, it's one of the reasons I like this referendum, is that we'd be bringing in money from taxpayers who are visitors and tourists. And I think that's another way to really help cover this deficit. So there is a benefit, I think, based off the tax on sales as opposed to property tax or any other option for payment of these debt.
Yeah. Thanks, Haley. Rory.
And that's right. I mean, if you were someone who's from Georgia, you're coming down here to enjoy the, you know, the world's largest actor cocktail party, which we're not allowed to say anymore, and you buy a beer and you pay
some
sales
tax. We're not allowed to say that anymore?
Yeah, allegedly they renamed it. It's a travesty. But, you know, you buy a beer and you're going to pay some sales tax, and that's money that we wouldn't otherwise get from, you know, a resident.
Taylor in Jacksonville, we have her back or him back. Hi, Taylor. Good morning.
Hi, I'm Melissa. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Well, my concerns with this are kind of threefold. One, and I think one of the most pressing issues, is that the plan wasn't properly managed to begin with, and as soon as it's become a problem, and we're now on the, like, you know, precipice of this financial meltdown the mayor's talking about, there hasn't really been any talk about ensuring that it will be properly managed the second time around. So we have a bucket with a bunch of holes in it, and we're just going to throw more water in it before we discuss fixing the, you know, the holes in the bucket. So, like, I haven't really heard about how we're going to ensure that this money is going to be properly allocated this time. And then on top of that, we have a bit of a broken policing system. We're still enforcing, like, war on drugs legislation, like this broken, like, law enforcement doctrine that we've been doing for decades that is not working. It's an economic hole. It drains massive amounts of resources out of our local communities, and we spend a huge sum of money keeping people that are essentially nonviolent, like, locked in cages, and we all know how expensive per head that it is to keep, you know, people interned instead of having them working productive, meaningful, you know, jobs where we can actually get tax revenue from them. So we haven't yet discussed maybe perhaps downsizing the police force and getting, you know, rid of these broken, you know, enforcement doctrines that we've been trying for decade over decade over decade that are not producing any meaningful results, that are not getting us ahead of what is essentially a medical problem. So until we really discuss that, and then on, you know, again, going back to the expenditure of law enforcement, we spend a lot of money on lawsuits, and we actually don't publicize the amount of money that the city and the county has to pay out when something goes awry. So we're not discussing, you know, perhaps body cameras to try to mitigate the legal liability that we pay, you know, end up having to pay
out
on.
Yeah. Thank you, Taylor. Thanks, Taylor. John McGowan.
Well, he talked about not fixing the problem and preventing it from moving forward. Now, one thing about this particular sales tax is that it can only be used to pay down the pension debt. It can't be used for something else. And that's one thing Mayor Curry has made a point about repeatedly. If we went to a property tax, the next city council could just start spending that money however they want. Using this is a dedicated source of revenue. It can't be spent anywhere else. Plus, the state legislature would not pass this for us to vote on it unless we included that there would be pension reform. And that is the next step. Just because this passes doesn't even mean it actually can happen. The mayor still has to negotiate with the FOP and with the firefighters to reform their pension plan to ensure this doesn't happen again. But this isn't really the firefighters or the police officers' fault. And I think it can feel like we're trying to blame them. Ultimately, this was the city didn't put in the money they were supposed to put in. They were spending it. You know, a lot of these things, it's a stick and carrot type of thing. If you do this, we get that. Well, we ate the carrot already. Now we've got left is the stick. So we have to pay for what we promised.
One more call. Let's go to Conrad on the north side. Hi, Conrad.
Yes, good morning. I'm with the concerned taxpayers and Just Say No. I was at the Just Say No forum at one of your competitor studios last night. There's two things that have been kind of seeping out, I guess, talking to people. One is, I remember all the way back when we conferred with Mike Weinstein and some of the other, Joey Grievous, I'm in the mayor's office back in January when this thing was forming up. Mike Weinstein birthed this baby in 2010, was going to use it for his platform had he been able to go ahead and run for mayor. He never gets credit for that. But he will, in a moment of confidence or whatever, talk about how even though this money will not be available until 2030, it will create a collateral factor where they can start bonding, and i.e. the Payton administration, while we could bond $50 million, we can't bond right now. That plus the employees, the general employees retirement fund people, I've talked to some of them in the last few days, they're voting yes.
Okay.
And the prediction is the mayor wants it to fail. He wants it to fail because then he can go to the one mill next year and say, I tried.
Oh, and do you really believe that?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Conrad. Rory Diamond.
Well, maybe he's on the legalization train also that the last caller was for the Taylor was talking about. No, I mean, I don't think the mayor is trying to use this as a pitch to try and get something down the road. That doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. But it is true that if we pass this, the actuarial analysis, the numbers analysis means that we will have more money today to spend on Jacksonville today. And that's what we're doing.
Okay. And then, John McGowan, your final thoughts. As you've said, you're a yes vote, but you still see out in your community at the beach a fair amount of pushback.
Yeah, and they do have legitimate concerns. And I believe that that's the thing, is we can't dismiss the concerns of the beach. We can't just say, well, they're being the beach people again. They're trying to do their own thing. It's a legitimate concern. We did not contribute as much to the problem as the city of Jacksonville did. Quite honestly, we'll suffer from the results. Well, if we don't get this resolved, we're going to suffer just as much as the rest of the community will.
Guys, thank you so much for giving us your thoughts today. We really appreciate you being here.
This
and
is great.
Crossing the ditch for our show.
It was a trek.
Rory Diamond, Vice President of Beaches Watch, Beaches businessman John McGowan. And later, a new era for the Women's Center of Jacksonville. But up next, as kids head back to school this month, here's a question. Are controversial school dress codes body shaming your daughter? We'll talk about that in a minute.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, since 9/11, the federal government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars to make America safer. 15 years later, the state of today's airline and border security, intelligence sharing, and counterterrorism efforts. At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Hello, this is Todd Smith, your Deputy Director for the City of Jacksonville's Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable foods, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are pleased to announce that Pedro Noguera, national expert on public education in America, is this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach, Saturday, October 8th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. For more information, visit wjct.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, here's a question currently making the rounds on social media. Is your daughter's school body shaming her with its dress code policies? Critics of rules for dress at many American schools say they are perpetuating antiquated, sexist, and harmful standards when it comes to how female students should dress. And they cite several highly controversial recent incidents all over the country where girls were ordered to go home and change, even though they were wearing what many would call perfectly acceptable attire. Now, on the other hand, supporters of school dress codes say these rules are necessary because too many girls, and sometimes boys, come to class wearing attire that's too risque for class. As school starts today in Duval or St. John's County and Monday in Duval, we're talking about dress codes right now, especially for girls. As we welcome Dr. Jenny Stuber, UNF Associate Professor of Sociology. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And parents, what do you think of your child's school dress code? Give us a call, 549 2937. And let me quote a recent piece about this on Mashable, Dr. Stuber, that was virally shared. It's time to stop body shaming your female students over their fashion choices. We're talking about incidents when a female student wears perfectly normal outfits to school and is told to cover up and go home. It affects their academic standing as well as makes them feel personally embarrassed and attacked. There is nothing wrong with, and I'm quoting here, showing your collarbone and wearing shorts in gym class that are above the knee. All right, I want to get your thoughts on this because I have two daughters. My older daughter has been told she cannot wear a shirt that shows collarbone. She has to wear gym shorts that go down to her knees. That's a change from when I was in high school. Your thoughts about this controversy?
A change from when I was in high school as well. And I think you and I are of a similar generation going through high school in the 1980s for the most part. And I remember growing up and my mom would tell me stories of her going to high school in the 1960s and how she would have to kneel on the floor. And if her skirt met the floor, touched the floor, she was okay. But if your skirt did not touch the floor in the 1960s, you would be sent home. And it looks like we're back to that kind of era in a sense with dress codes that police young women's cleavage or their tushes or their bellies or the type of fabric that they're wearing. We're back to that era, it seems.
You see that as body shaming?
I see it as policing of female bodies. And in a way, while I just said that we're back to an earlier era of the 1960s, when this was something that I heard stories of during the 1980s and laughed, it also reflects something that I think is more inherent, is that girls grow up and their bodies are constantly policed. I want to mention a really exciting study, an interesting study done by Karen Martin, and she studied preschools. And in these preschools that she studied, one of the patterns that she observed is that as early as 2, 3, and 4 years old, young girls' clothing was consistently touched by the preschool instructors. They would have their skirts pulled down. They would be told to close their legs. They would have their tights adjusted. And that's just sort of an earlier moment where girls grow up learning that their bodies are available for public correction and public policing.
In a way that isn't done with boys.
That isn't for boys. And it's interesting that you bring up boys as a point of comparison because girls aren't the only ones whose bodies are being policed through dress codes. You can also see some dress codes that have racial implications to them, as well as LGBT implications to them, as well as body size shaming involved as well. But girls' dress codes are probably the most prominent that we're hearing about these days.
And that I posted a question about this on my own Facebook page, and it was just an incredible debate and split right down the middle. Now, let me quote again from this piece. One of the most common reasons to tell a female student to cover up is because it distracts the male students and even teachers around her. This kind of thinking only serves to cement rape culture, the last thing that should be taught in school. It reinforces victim blaming, telling girls it's their fault if they're sexually harassed or assaulted. Kids aren't mindless predators. Give them some credit. Give the boys some credit, in other words. What do you think about that?
I agree with those sentiments entirely. And I would also point out that during eras in which women wore more clothing and less form-fitting clothing, like the grunge era in which I went to college, and in the 1980s when clothing was very loose and not drawing attention to one's tush or their cleavage or any other body part, I don't think that rates of sexual assault were any lower in those eras. So I don't know that there is any type of correlation between how much flesh a young woman is showing and the degree to which she's a distraction or which she's a potential victim of sexual assault.
What's driving this change in dress codes? Girls can't wear a V-neck T-shirt to school. They have to wear gym shorts that go all the way to the knee. Those are the two that stand out the most locally that I've heard about. Because as you said, this is sort of a pendulum swinging back in terms of the change in policy that we've seen in recent years.
If I had to speculate on why we're seeing this now, I would look at other patterns in the research that generally suggest that during times of maybe rapid social change or social change that we don't quite understand and feels a little bit out of control, there tends to be a reactionary moment. So what I'm suggesting is that as women gain more freedom in society, as women gain more rights in society, even as women become in some ways more represented in higher education than men and have better economic outcomes, especially among those who are experiencing higher education, that becomes a moment when they get reined in yet again. So it's kind of a counterbalance or
counterbalancing. It's a backlash that actually goes all the way down to middle school.
Yeah.
Subconsciously.
Yeah.
Interesting. And what would you say, though, to parents who like the dress codes? They think, look, I'm in favor of modesty for girls and boys.
Yeah. I think the framing of the dress code is really important. As your evidence and your reporting has suggested, that a lot of the dress code is justified as a way to prevent girls from being a distraction to boys. And so there's a lot of sexualization in the dress codes. And that motivation, I think, could be reframed as one of professionalism and moving from a concern about modesty to a concern about professionalism in general. So I think a dress code can be perfectly appropriate if we understand that it is a gender-neutral dress code, and the goal of the dress code is to enforce sort of a self-awareness of what proper dress is, whatever that means, and that is a loaded term, but towards one of expressing professionalism.
Do you think school boards across the country are starting to hear that argument? Because increasingly, especially on social media, there's been a pushback to the dress codes.
Yeah, there has been a pushback.
Students themselves are posting their outrage and their parents.
Yeah, right now it's hard to detect the trends here because there's not a lot of distinction in the research between a dress code and a uniform. So we know that uniforms are more common in schools these days, but we're not really sure if these dress codes are more common themselves, these types that we're discussing here. But there is, I think, kind of these exciting moments fronted by both boys and girls in schools where they're reacting against some of the things that they're seeing in school as kind of oppressive of their self-expression. And I like that. I like social movements of that kind.
It's tough for a school, though, to find the right balance. I mean, you've got kids, a very diverse group of kids in schools, especially big urban schools. It's certainly not easy.
No, it's not. And I think safety is of great importance. And I think a broader socialization of what is professional and what's expected of young adults out in the world is a bottom line that I think should be expressed as well.
Here's a tweet. My high school, Terry Parker class of 2000, had a dress code, but the cheerleaders' uniforms somehow didn't apply. Okay, let's go to Farah in Jacksonville. Farah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the person you're interviewing is absolutely right. It's sexist. It's a form of racism. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. If you like your children to be modest, dress your children modestly. I like my children to be modest. There's a lot of things I wouldn't let my daughter wear. But quite frankly, I don't care if someone else wears a bikini. As long as you're covered, you're covered. And as far as the distraction, there's a certain percentage of children that are always going to seek attention, and they'll find other ways to be distracting and get that attention. And there's a certain segment of children that will be distracted by the change in direction of the wind. So all that's just kind of really, I don't know, just a filler that they put in to make excuses. It's all just sexist, and it's all against women, and it's all ridiculous.
Thank you, Farah. One more tweet. Where is the line between freedom of expression and indecency? I guess we still are finding the solution to that. Your final thoughts, Dr. Stuber?
My final thoughts are that this stuff kind of matters. Like, I am, just like the previous caller, concerned about the policing of women's bodies and sexism. This long-term pattern of correcting women's bodies for showing too much skin or for taking up too much space or showing your tush or whatever it happens to be. Amy Cuddy, the professor at Harvard Business School, talks about this in a concept that she calls the power pose, in that the long-term consequences are that when women's bodies are constantly policed and they become small in their expression, that leads to a lack of self-confidence, and that men's bodies, because they're a little bit less constrained by clothing or by taking up too much space or showing body parts that are inappropriate, leads them to have a greater sense of confidence in their bodies. And I think that's a really important thing to look at, is not just in terms of what is it appropriate to wear to school, but what are these long-term consequences of receiving messages about the appropriateness or lack thereof of our bodies.
Thanks for sharing that with us. She's Dr. Jenny Stuber, Associate Professor of Sociology at UNF. And we'll be right back.
A Syrian refugee cooks at the church that's helping her establish a life in this country.
When they eat Syrian food, they like it they come back again to eat it.
The pastor, who leads an interfaith coalition, plans to welcome more refugees.
We have more congregations who are active in our coalition than we will have families arriving.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a safe harbor for refugees in New Jersey, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Wouldn't it be nice to know what's in the local daily newspaper, even if you have blindness or diminishing eyesight? WJCT's radio reading service can help. You'll hear what's in the Florida Times Union every day. Articles, op-eds, obituaries, even the comics. Sign up at wjct.org/radio reading. Our thanks to the Florida Eye Specialists, Delta Gamma of UNF, and the Uptown Civitan Club for helping give voice to the printed word.
Presenting Next Avenue, a website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue.
Sponsored in part by AARP. Real possibilities.
Welcome back. Well, stay cool out there this week and show us how much you love WJCT with our I Love WJCT Instagram contest. This week's theme is Beat the Heat. Post a photo on Instagram showing us how you're staying cool and supporting WJCT. Use the hashtag ILoveWJCT. We'll publish our favorite photo of the week in our Friday First Read newsletter. Subscribe to it at WJCTnews.org. Finally, this hour, it's a new chapter for the Women's Center of Jacksonville. The organization's annual Celebration of Women event is coming up this Friday night. We've got a preview right now with Executive Director Teresa Miles and Board President Lisa Everly. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Melissa. We're glad to be here.
Thanks for being with us. The Women's Center of Jacksonville, I did not know this, started some 20-odd years ago in a single rented room in an old house in Riverside.
That is correct.
Pretty humble beginnings.
Absolutely.
And from there, it's really grown. Let's talk about the arc of that over the years.
Well, I tell you, it really has been a community effort. I think a lot of folks have come together to really make it what it is today, a real committed board of directors, amazing staff. We serve, over 10,000 women and families in our community each year. This past year, just since January, I know we've fielded well over 1,500 hotline calls from individuals who are facing sexual assault in our community. So we have expanded our services, not just providing counseling, but also services that are specific to needs that we see.
And that's one big issue, Lisa, but the center does other important work too, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the programs that is relatively new to us is our program called Women Renewed, coming out of the prison system. And in the last year, in 3 years that it has been in existence, we've served over 450 women coming out of prison. And the recidivism rate has been around 23%, where it is nationally over 60%. So that program has been a great success in helping women come out of the prison system and join society again.
Sure. And with you now installed as a new leader, Teresa, you're setting out a bold agenda for the Women's Center of Jacksonville, a new chapter, and one way people can support it is by coming out to your big Celebration of Women event this Friday night. What's going to be happening?
Actually, Melissa, it is next Friday
next
night.
Next Friday night. I said next Friday night, not this Friday night. No, I screwed that up. Next Friday night.
Yes, absolutely. We are looking forward to it. This will be my first, so I'm very excited about it. We are doing something a little different this year. We're hoping folks will come out. We are doing something called a Gifts of Love, which is kind of a unique way that we are trying to highlight the needs of women in our community. And we have some phenomenal silent and live auction items, wonderful food, wonderful folks.
And this is at Deerwood Country Club, 6:30 p.m. next Friday.
That's correct.
People can go to womenscenterofjax.org, womenscenterofjax.org to get their tickets. And an easy way to support the work of the Women's Center of Jacksonville. Lisa, 10,000 women served each year, but with more funding, you could serve even more.
Well, absolutely. And I think one of my goals as president in the upcoming couple of years is to raise awareness about our agency, because even though we've been in existence for 20 years and we serve that many women, every day I run into women who've never heard of us. And that has to change. And so we are going to continue to raise awareness of our agency and our services, and that will take more money to serve those women, definitely.
So support the Women's Center of Jacksonville as they've grown over 20 years in this community. It's the Celebration of Women event coming up next Friday at Deerwood Country Club. Go to womenscenterofjax.org to get your ticket. new Executive Director Teresa Miles and Board President Lisa Everly, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. You can never miss a show if you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or download it at the NPR One app. And watch the show with video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Some segments also at MetroJacksonville.com. And next on Diane Rehm, since 9/11, the federal government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars to make America safer. 15 years later, a look at the state of today's airline and border security, intelligence sharing, and counterterrorism efforts. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.